So today is March the 10th, it's 3:15 p.m. and I'm here with Mr. Norm Hudson. We are doing an interview and all right, thank you very much, Mr. Hudson, for being here.
No problem, sure.
So I've read in a lot of different articles that you've done a lot of different waterfront projects before. How was Granville Island different, or was it in any way any inspiration for doing anything else, or how was it significant compared to the other ones?
Well, Granville Island was one of the first major waterfront projects that my firm was involved in. So it really, in a way, it was a seminal piece of work because it actually led to many other opportunities in Canada and even abroad. And what it established was a very solid kind of foundation about how you undertake planning of fairly large-scale sites, and particularly ones that have some history to them. Because we developed for Granville Island a set of principles, and we've found that those principles even can apply to other properties that are even quite different from Granville Island, but they're sort of, I guess, generic enough that sometimes we're able to apply a lot of the thinking that went into Granville Island in a different context. We're sometimes asked by clients to sort of do another Granville Island, and we say, well, that won't happen. Because it was absolutely, the circumstances were unique at a point in time. Whether it's physical, whether it's the politics of the day, you know, some of the issues that were current at the time, and so on, and those are, a lot of those influences just aren't present today. So I don't know that you really can't pick something up and move it somewhere else, you know.
And where did the inspiration came from?
The inspiration for the island came from itself. So really, what we were dealing with was an existing fabric of streets, railway lines, docks, the bulkhead wall around the perimeter, and an amazing collection of buildings, that industrial-type buildings, that most of which were heavy timber construction, but quite a different type, you know, a lot of different types of buildings. They didn't all look the same, a lot of diversity. And so this arrangement of all of these parts really was the inspiration, because we said, how can we build on this existing fabric in a very positive way, and yet turn it from primarily industrial to primarily public use? And so I could not, frankly, point to any individual precedent anywhere else in the world. There were a few things that influenced us. For example, travels to Europe, Western Europe, and some of the sort of streetscapes that you might experience in Western Europe. Certainly, I think, were a bit of a factor in terms of how we designed our streets. Visits to places like the Pike Place Market in Seattle, which was operating, of course, at the time, and this was in 1977, and it was a very exciting mixture of market, retail, restaurant, housing, you know, quite a nice mixture of things down there. So that certainly was an inspiration for the public market, which we also designed. And then I suppose, you know, there were a few places like Ghirardelli Square or Pier 39, I think it is, in San Francisco. And these were examples of public use activity, festival markets, you know, that sort of thing. There were some U.S. examples Baltimore, New York City, there were things being done by U.S. developers that were of interest because we learned both good things and bad things from those. And I think we wanted to hopefully learn from those experiences and benefit from that. But really, it was the character of the place itself that set the stage for what we did there.
Perfect. And then the third question is, how was it in terms of architecture? How did it differ? How did you change it to what it is, or what it was in between, let's say, 1960s and later 1970s?
Right.
How was it different?
Transformed?
Exactly.
Yes, okay. So, in the late 60s and early 70s, it was a very busy industrial place. The buildings, to my knowledge, the buildings were all occupied. They were all industrial purpose. They were busy. There was a lot of activity. For example, there were boxcars oftentimes on the rail lines being loaded with finished product. There were barges coming into the shoreline. It was a very busy working place, right? We actually recommended to Canada Mortgage and Housing that they not buy out all the industrial leases, which they had started to do, because our point was it started as an industrial place. This established its character, mm-hmm. both in terms of use and in terms of architecture and all kinds of things. So don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, why not keep some of that? And so we actually managed to convince them to keep at least six fairly major industrial operations down there and to not continue to buy them out. And that was positive because it actually saved them money. And it meant that we were actually able to use some of that money in the redevelopment. So moving specifically to the architecture, a lot of these buildings were actually moved here from other places originally. Industries would come in, they would lease a plot of land, and then they would either build a new building or move an old building here. As a result, many of these operations were sort of pieces of buildings put together, added onto, and so on. And so some of the arrangements of buildings was quite peculiar, which again added to its character. So what we tried to do in principle was to recycle everything, to reuse all the built form down there. What we found was that some things like sheds or some of the buildings were just too far gone, so to speak, to really be able to keep them. So a few buildings disappeared, but for the most part, we kept the buildings in place. The next step was to look at each building, knowing that we had some ideas about a very broad mix of land use. And so we actually looked at each building and said, well, what does that building lend itself to? So I'll give you one example. The building where the Arts Club Theater is located on the island actually has a long span. It's about a 70-foot clear span roof. So we knew a building that was column-free would be a good building for a theater. And sure enough, the theater fit in there perfectly. There was another building that's now part of the Maritime Market, which was a very tall building, and it was about 55 feet. In fact, it was the tallest building on the island. And so we thought, okay, that building would be a great building to put big objects inside, like boats. So we said, let's make that part of the boatyard, and we will keep this big open space, this covered space, as a place where boats could be worked on. And interestingly, the peak of that building, the peak of the roof of that building at 55 feet, we decided to make that the maximum height allowable on Granville Island. So we took the tallest building and that became our height limit. And we have adhered to that to this day. Mm-hmm. So each building, you know, we try to assess the opportunities, and Where it was located on the island was also important. For example, there are about 7 buildings that we brought together to form the public market. And it was located at the west end of the island. It was on the waterfront. It meant that as a really important commercial use, it would draw people to that place on the island. And so we said this would make a great market, and that became the public market. So it was really interesting how all the different land uses were selected. And a lot of it had to do with the types of buildings, the size of the buildings, and the condition of the buildings. One other final point maybe on the has to do with the architecture. And one of the principles we thought was important was to maintain the industrial character of the island. There were lots of people who said, well, you know, why don't you just tear everything down and do some nice new buildings? Having decided to keep the buildings, we also wanted to keep the character of the buildings. So even when they were renovated or added on to, we wanted to maintain the heritage materials, the colors, the large doorways, the multi-paned windows, all of those character-defining elements that you'll see at Granville Island, we thought should be kept, but not to a point of sort of being so strict that one couldn't, in fact, venture into some contemporary design as well. So you'll notice there are some new buildings on the island that are contemporary buildings that were built from brand new in the 70s or 80s, and they have this interesting crossover where they might use some of the original industrial materials or the kind of color palette, but they are definitely not trying to mimic a 1920s building. They're, you know, and one example would be the building, the south building of the Emily Carr University, which was designed by the Packhouse, and that's a very, very contemporary building, all concrete and glass, but it still makes use of industrial forms and industrial materials like corrugated steel cladding and things like that.
And did it change since late 1970s till now? Did it change any major changes that was done, or was it just kept same way?
I don't think there have been significant changes since if you could say there was a completion, it would have been in the early 80s. I've always argued the island is like a piece of the city. It will never be complete. There's still a half a dozen sites that have never been developed or occupied, other than perhaps by parking, like, you know, there's some indoor parking in some of these buildings, kind of where the buildings are waiting to be used for some other purpose, so we've temporarily used them for parking. But there haven't been a lot of significant changes from the original conception of the plan, other than perhaps in the makeup of land uses. So there's no doubt that there's been some changes in land use, not always, you know, for the most positive either. I mean, for example, in the Maritime Market area on the southwest side of the island, you're starting to see a number of uses coming into that area that really don't have much to do with maritime activity or boats or sailing or what have you. And the original premise there was that all tenants had to have something to do with maritime activity. And now you're starting to see shops coming in there that are a little bit more general retail, and certainly some of them with a leaning towards tourism, and for me, that's a serious problem, because tourism is the one thing that can actually really hurt a place if it becomes too dominant, and you'll find that a place might be pretty active in the summer time, but not so active in the winter time. So we've always said, look, Granville Island is a place for the people of Vancouver, and hopefully tourists will enjoy it as well. But it's not first and foremost for tourists. And I think that is something that's actually shifting as time passes.
And you mentioned originally, would that be in 1920s? Or originally, if they had to use the...
No. The maritime market was something that I created in 1977. Okay. Yeah, it was an idea that I came up with. Mm-hmm. We thought, well, we're going to have a food market. Why don't we have a maritime market? And it sells things that have to do with boating, yachting, you know, sailboating, power boating, and both for perhaps some things that might cater to fishermen, for example, to stock their boats or whatever, or to repair their boats, or some things that would be more for the private boater. In the end, it's more oriented towards the private boater. There are sales agents down here for various types of boats. There's boat repairs, boat haul out. There's things like the Lobster Man, where you can actually buy fresh lobster. You know, there used to be in this very long, narrow building. We thought that's a perfect building for a spar maker, which is, you know, the mass of sailing boats. And sure enough, we were able to get a spar maker in there. And for many years, they pulled the masts out the end, and they would raise them on a big tower thing they had, and they would drop the masts into sailboats. And then after a period of time, for whatever reason, I don't know, that tenant left, and now it's more broken up into smaller tenancies. But that's what happens over time. I mean, obviously, as time passes, tenants will change over, and sometimes, you know, I think the original intentions may not be fully realized with some of the replacement tenants. Mm-hmm. That's where business kind of comes into it too, you know.
Okay. So the next question is about the material that they were using. You mentioned that there were a lot of timber, was heavily used before. Mr. Kluckner mentioned something about the architecture, how it was different from 1920s. It was more engineer built, and then in 1950s it was more architectural. Built. Is that true? I mean, some of the buildings, I believe, were somewhere around here. They had the art deco.
Yes,
elements.
They do. That's right. Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's a good observation. There's no question. The earliest buildings were very basic. Mm-hmm. Simple grids, you know, a regular grid of dimensions, and simple columns, beams, trusses. So very much more of an engineered solution. And then there's no doubt that there was a point in time when people started to think more about the facade appearances, and there's no doubt there were some applications then of Art Deco and maybe certain materials and so on. I would say, though, that the real influx of the involvement of architects occurred starting in about 1979, when we were actually redeveloping buildings, and in that. At that time, every building had to have an architect in order to, you know, proceed with any redevelopment. And that's when you really started to see more interventions, mm-hmm. and where the character certainly started to change a bit more. Yeah.
What were the main, for the new buildings that you built? Or what did you add in terms of material? What should we look for new materials?
Most of the materials in new buildings or in buildings that are completely renovated were materials that were indigenous to the island. So the common materials were stucco, painted stucco, corrugated steel cladding, either galvanized or painted. In a couple of instances, there were even buildings that had cedar shingles on exterior walls. There were a few buildings that had concrete block walls, and this was a material that we didn't really encourage for redevelopment. We thought the concrete block was maybe just a little bit raw. Although you'll see some buildings that were built of concrete block. I mean, the simplest way to change them was to perhaps paint the block a nice color. But it was not a material we used a lot in terms of any new construction or reconstruction. So those would be the principal materials. There are probably a handful of other things, but I would say the stucco and the corrugated steel were the dominant materials on the exterior of buildings. Roofs were commonly asphalt shingle or corrugated steel would be the most common. And then a lot of the roofs are actually flat, and so they were typically a built-up, you know, sort of tar and gravel type roof.
So if you, because basically what I'm doing here is trying to go into more detail in two of the buildings. If you were to choose two of the buildings, which two would you say had the most significant change, or could you recall anything?
I guess I could speak to a couple. Bridges Restaurant, which is, of course, the one on the West Point here. Mm-hmm. That was interesting. It was occupied by, I think, Standard General Construction, and it was a building that was built out of corrugated steel cladding, and it was painted yellow. And in the redevelopment of that building, the restaurant actually wanted to clad the new building in white stucco, and I think they even were considering a tile, like a red tile roof, kind of a Spanish revival, and we said absolutely not. It has to be yellow corrugated steel, because it was very iconic at the end. But what was interesting about the way that was built was they actually deconstructed the existing building, laid it all out on the ground, and they lowered the height by about 10 or 15 feet. I just forget the exact number. But what they discovered is that the original building was so high inside that it really would have been overscaled for a restaurant facility, even a two-story restaurant, which is what they built. So we agreed to let them bring it down by, I think it was around 15 feet. So that was an example of one of the more extreme cases where they actually took the building down, reused the timber, posts, columns, and trusses, but rebuilt it in a slightly different configuration. The overall size and shape of the building was very much the same as the original, but it was actually a little more squat in its height. And then they did finally agree to use the original kind of materials and colors that we wanted. So that was an example where I think it was a good illustration of how people can sort of work together to solve a problem. You know, like they want to do certain things and I wanted certain things, and we ended up coming to a resolution. Another example I think that's an interesting one is actually the public market, and I can maybe speak to that a bit more fully because, you know, I was the actual designer of that assemblage of buildings. And what was interesting there was we were able to take what in the end I think amounted to 7 separate buildings that were all sort of beside each other, and interlink them on the inside so that we could create a singular sort of interior space and activity. But when you actually experience that now, as you walk through the market, you will actually notice each different building, and they're they are quite different, actually, as you move through them. Some are low, some are very high with peaked roofs. A couple of the buildings, we actually maintain the old gantry cranes that ran the length of the building to lift materials, mainly used in steel fabrication. So the gantry cranes we just left as artifacts. And I think it's a good example of a project where I know when we did the original construction of that, which comprised of about three of the seven buildings, it was only $1.2 million of construction value, which today seems like nothing. But then at that time, we were able to outfit these buildings so that tenants could actually move in and start operating the public market. So I think it's an example of how you can do things modestly. You don't have to spend a ton of money to make either a successful building or a successful project. I think it's a good example of modesty in a sense, and that design, you know, can be done in ways that give you a pretty good result, because it is one of the best markets in North America, and yet it was really built on a very modest budget. So,
my last question is, do you have any suggestions on what else I should be looking for about the transformation of that?
Well, one of the other areas that you haven't asked about, which goes to the outside spaces, mm-hmm, rather than the built spaces, is really the makeup of streets and public space. And there are some very important ideas that are embedded in the way that was done that I think in the end has added a great deal to the ambience of the place. And so one of the principal ideas in the street space was to firstly retain the patterns and the shapes of the street layouts, and they were actually all formed by railway lines. You can actually see from this plan how the original rail lines created these triangulations in the street pattern and the curvatures that are inherent in the, like in Anderson Street and so on. And so the whole layout of the island was really derived from how rail traffic moves. And that's a really interesting thing in terms of the overall pattern. Another thing that we haven't spoken about, but the other pattern that's important, is that all the buildings around the perimeter of the island against the waterfront edges are all perpendicular to the waterfront. And the reason for that is that all of the raw product that was generally used in the manufacturing process of these businesses came in by barge. Mm-hmm. So you'd have product arriving by water, going through the actual buildings where things were manufactured, and then the finished products were loaded on rail cars and shipped across to, you know, BC or even across Canada or into the US. And so that's an interesting thing about the history of the island, because it has to do with the very shape of it, and this kind of triangular shape. When we moved to the streets, the thing that we were trying to do there was to build what today we would call multimodal streets. In those days, people saw them as just chaotic streets, right? But today, all over the world, these kind of streets are being designed. And it's the idea that you can put vehicles, bicycles, people, delivery trucks, and so on, into a common space, and they can basically sort it out in a safe manner, right? To help that along, because we knew we weren't sure whether the citizens of Vancouver would quite appreciate streets that were that sort of casual, we did install what we call a street hardware system, which is a pole and pipe arrangement that is held off of the buildings by about 10 feet so that there actually are protected areas that you can walk. If you feel uncomfortable walking down the middle of the street, you can get into what effectively is like a sidewalk. But you'll notice there are no curbs. There's a few curbs just where we needed to guide traffic movements around corners. Where there's some curb traffic movements, there are some curbs. We felt it offered a bit of a guidance to the driver and a bit of protection to the pedestrian. But generally speaking, these streets are flush with one material. It's all unit concrete pavers, and it's a material that makes it look more like it's a pedestrian area, and then it suggests then that the car is an intervener into the pedestrian realm. And that has resulted in the traffic speeds being much lower, and it's one of the safest places in the city. To my knowledge, there's only been one accident where a pedestrian was hit in 37 years. Yeah. So the design of the streets is actually a huge part of the design of the entire place. In fact, if anything, the buildings are more background buildings, more of a backdrop. And it's really, the things that you really notice are what's happening in the public realm, in the streets, and the things at the main floor level. You know, the activities, being able to walk by the lobster man and see, large basins of lobsters or crabs or whatever, and being able to just walk in the big doorway and actually pick one and buy one and things. It's that interaction between the activity inside the buildings and the street itself that is a very important part of the concept of the island. This has to do with the idea of seeing things made. So you'll notice there are lots of places on the island where you can actually see artisans and craftsmen working, and oftentimes their doors or their windows are wide open. You can walk in, talk to the artist, buy something if you want to buy it, and it's a very important part of the ambiance of the island as well. Yeah. Yeah, good. So I don't know if we dealt as much with heritage per se. One of the things I would just add as well is that Granville Island is not designated in any fashion, and we've always simply referred to the building, to the place, as having a number of significant older buildings. Mm-hmm. They're not heritage buildings. There are no heritage rules or guidelines that really apply here, other than we did develop some early guidelines around how developers and their architects should respond to if they were renovating a building and so on. There are some written guidelines that were done in the late 70s, but to be honest, they're not. I don't think they're really applied that much today. I think there's sort of a natural kind of response on the part of any designer working on something on the island that they kind of get it and respond in an appropriate way to the place. There's a few things that have been done that I would not have done, or maybe chosen different colors or something. But it is interesting that it, has taken on a bit of a life of its own. The next big milestone, of course, will be what happens to Emily Carr, to the buildings that Emily Carr has occupied, because those buildings are 20% of the existing floor space of Granville Island. So it's a large amount of space that's going to be coming available.
How much of their space is in historic buildings? I know they have the big modern buildings.
Right, so the older buildings hold about 120,000 square feet. And the new building is around 70,000 square feet. Yeah.
So it's significant what happens with that space.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
And they're, it's interesting that they're in two, so that's I think actually a good thing, because you know what happens on the south side could be quite separate, mm-hmm. and maybe of different character than what happens on the north.
Mm-hmm.
And also the north side are a whole series of buildings, again perpendicular to the waterfront, that were interlinked, just like the public market, to create Emily Carr.
Mm-hmm.
They could be separated again. So you could actually, if you wanted to, end up with, I don't know how many it is, 4 or 5 completely separate buildings with smaller tenancies or something. So there's a lot of mm-hmm. possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Was this also your plan?
Mm-hmm.
Was this also a plan that you...
I did not do the architecture of Emily Carr. It was done by another firm.
Mm-hmm.
But we picked the location, the use, and you know, some of the influences. Like there's a little walk-through
mm-hmm.
area. This end, the north end, is actually a different occupancy. It's not part of Emily Carr.
Okay.
And so there were a lot of guidelines around sort of how that should be sort of dealt with. As a separate entity.
Mm-hmm.
But the building was actually done by another firm
mm-hmm.
for the provincial government.
Could you elaborate a little bit on the different roles in the work that was done? So obviously your
yes.
involvement was in the overall plan.
That's correct.
As well as
yeah.
some quite detailed
it was.
Planning, right? And then
That's
others
correct.
Were involved in
yeah.
individual buildings.
Yeah, so... The way it was set up, managed by Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation on behalf of the Government of Canada, there's a management group that a part of CMHC that is located down here that actually manages the island, so they have their own internal management group here. And then we were hired as the sort of urban design architect to come up with a physical plan.
And what was what was your firm's name at that?
Norman Hodson Architects.
Okay,
yeah.
That's easy.
Norman Hodson Architects.
Yep.
And so that was the firm that actually did the majority of the work at Granville Island. We worked in concert with an economic consultant called Urbanics Consultants,
mm-hmm.
and they did an economic plan or a business plan that matched up with the physical plan.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really great approach because the two are fully integrated. So often, actually, plans are done without the influence of economics,
mm-hmm.
and then sometimes they're hard to implement because
mm-hmm.
it hasn't been thought of. In this case, it was an integrated approach. And that led to certain land uses and quantities of uses, and it resulted in a rent structure, which is a very interesting part of Granville Island because of the fact that some tenants pay full rent and some tenants are not for profit. And so I call it the Robin Hood principle.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been, I think, very successful actually, and has allowed us to have things like artists and craftsmen and so on that just can't pay full rent.
Mm-hmm.
So then, my role initially was working with colleagues who are still here, actually,
mm-hmm.
Like Jos Bakker, to come up with a physical plan for the redevelopment. Then CMHC also hired us to oversee that plan and its implementation.
Mm-hmm.
And so for probably 30 years, I was the consulting architect or
mm-hmm.
executive architect or whatever for CMHC to review all designs on the island, whether they were a proposal for a new building or a proposal for a sign or a proposal to repaint a building or whatever. I did all of the design review work for everything on the island. That was what allowed it to have this sort of level of control
mm-hmm.
of, you know, what was actually realized down there. So that was a very important role. I haven't been doing it for close to 8 years now, but it was a really important part of the development process. The third role that we had was we designed all of the streets and public areas, working with landscape architects
mm-hmm.
and civil engineers and so on. So we actually designed the public realm. And then finally, we've been also the architects on some of the buildings, like the public market, for example, and a few others. So we've had a multifaceted role down there over the years. And we still actually perform work for CMHC. For example, if they need a new roof on a building, they might come to us and ask us to oversee the specifications and so on for the roof and to supervise it during construction and that sort of thing. So it's been an amazing multifaceted kind of project for us for the last, you know, 38 years or something.
I was interested in your comments about the heritage aspect, and what's your view on sort of where that could go or should go in the future in terms of recognizing the heritage value of the island?
I would suggest that Granville Island should be recognized as a either a historic or a heritage district, but that it's probably the individual buildings are not worthy of heritage status. But as a precinct, it should probably be somehow recognized. It would be similar to Gastown or Chinatown or Yaletown, which are also, or Shaughnessy, I guess, First Shaughnessy, which is kind of acknowledged to be a where the whole context of a neighborhood is the important thing, not so much the individual buildings, per se. And I think it would be worthy of that. It is recognized all over the world as a very significant piece of you know, both social and physical kind of development, you know, and it's been as a project, it's been very important to the city of Vancouver, I think, in its evolution, actually. And it's, of course, now, I mean, it's known by so many people, not only across Canada, but from other countries as well. One of those places to go, right? Hence tourism. But I think it'd be really interesting if it had a little more status from a heritage point of view.
Because at the moment it is a void on the
not at all
the heritage register and so on, right? It's sort of, there's nothing more.
And so you know, one of the thoughts there is, and this fits the federal piece, is that it could be a national historic site in some ways, and it again, it wouldn't be so much because of the buildings, but I mean, I'm working on the CPR Roundhouse site in Victoria, which is a national historic site under the federal designations, right? And it's got, you know, it's got three old brick buildings sitting on it and a turntable, right? And that was significant enough to make it a national historic site. Well, I think this is the equal to that, if not more, you know, in many ways. So that would be an interesting approach, because it would actually recognize that it's, in this case, it's even federally owned land. I mean, a lot of the national historic sites aren't even federally owned, as is the case of the Roundhouse. It's actually privately owned by a developer, yet it's a significant historic site nationally. So this would be a great one. It's something that might be worth talking to Heritage Canada about. And I'm kind of connected a bit with Heritage Canada, because I sit on the board of the National Capital Commission, which is which falls under the jurisdiction of Canadian Heritage. So I might actually be able to connect something there.
Slip that idea.
Yeah.
I mean, we're certainly very interested in it, with the whole review of the Heritage Register having been initiated at the city level, and this coming forward as an area of that's missing, clearly has significance, both for its historic uses, but also for the transformation of
exactly.
it. It's not just a historic story.
So maybe it could be fitted into your process as well somehow. I think it would be, because to be honest, I'm a little bit worried about the long term, and you know, just to what extent is it, will it be respected as time passes, you know, and will it get, is there a chance that things could get a bit goofy down mm-hmm. there?
Mm-hmm.
And, because, you know, sometimes, and, you know, it's probably quite reasonable, but people come along and say, oh, well, I've got this great new idea for Granville Island. It should be this, or it should be that, or something, right? Yes. And if there's any momentum behind that, it could really affect the historic fabric of mm-hmm. the place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
So we need to work on that one.
Did you have any other questions, Yasmin? No? Okay. No, I think that was very helpful. Yes.
The minister, this Melanie Joly,
mm-hmm.
is the minister of Canadian Heritage,
yes.
and she is also the minister responsible for the National Capital Commission. Mm-hmm. So maybe I can get an entree to her someday yeah. and plant the seed. Yeah.
Yes. And I think a benefit, of course, of having it recognized in that way is, as you say, it would be a way to ensure some at least documentation or clarification of the intent that
yeah.
then there's some continuity yeah. because it is so popular in terms of the tourist draw that there is that risk
right,
that
right.
that it the understanding of it becomes that rather than the historic role
right.
that it's
the had. One downside is that when that status is given to a building, at least, or a complex of buildings, typically you then have to follow the standards and guidelines for the, whatever it's called, preservation of historic places in Canada. I forget the exact title, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And that's very strict.
Yes.
And these buildings are probably not meritus of that kind of
mm-hmm.
scrutiny. In other words, it could put some real
yes.
clamps on one's ability to, you know, open up the end of a building for some new use if you needed more glass, right? Because
yeah.
they'd look at the existing building and say, oh, no, the window's that big and that's all you're allowed to have in the end of that building, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's how strict those guidelines are. So that's why I'm for me, it's more about the place mm-hmm. than it is about individual
yeah.
buildings.
Yeah.
And there'd have to be some way of, if it did achieve status like that, there'd have to be some way, I think, where you still had some flexibility on
mm-hmm.
on the way, you know, things are reused and, mm-hmm. and repurposed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are there any buildings on the island that stand out on their own as having merit? From a historic point of view, I mean, you say there's generally not.
Yeah,
but
is there
any exceptions to that, or are they?
You know, again, it's really hard to point to mm-hmm. any, you know, one. And many of them have been. There's been interventions that are pretty substantial.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, this the hotel. Your plan's a bit out of date. There's actually a wing on the hotel here as well, which we did a number of years ago, but. This is an old building. This is an old building, and this was an old building, but it was taken down and replaced. So there's pieces. There's two old buildings sitting in here. You can hardly see them today because
right.
the way it's all been sort of put together. So you there's just no way you could. I don't think you could reference that as an historic building, right? Some like this one. This one's pretty intact. This building where the boats are put inside, it's
right.
pretty intact actually
yeah.
from its very original when we at least happened upon it.
Mm-hmm.
So you know that's an example, I guess, of one that you might say is close enough to what it was many many years ago. That but again, you know, like I don't think you'd want to come in here and start saying, well, there's actually three historic
yeah.
buildings here,
yeah.
right? It somehow paints the wrong picture, I think.
Well, then it seems the essence of the island from the 1920s on has always been one of change.
It has.
And
yeah.
using buildings in different ways, as you say, bringing
yeah.
in buildings, moving buildings, cutting buildings in half and
yeah,
repurposing
exactly.
them.
Yeah.
So
it's
to,
always been
to
like
now
that.
Just say, well, that's stopped and we don't do that
and
anymore
we,
would probably
and to just freeze
that.
It and yeah. say, well, we're going to keep it exactly the way it is, that might not be the best thing either. So.
Yeah. An interesting one to ponder
yeah.
how to
yeah,
do that
yeah, yeah,
well.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, it might be better, like rather than going the National Historic Site route, it might be better just to use the cities, and maybe it's the province as well, I've just forgotten now, the designated areas
like
that we have.
Like a conservation area or a historic area.
Right. It might be better just to stick with that as a format.
Can't you put the streets and like the actual outside areas under the preservation code?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Because the way those have been set up, it tends to be connected to buildings.
Yeah.
Built
yeah,
form,
I know.
Exteriors, yeah. and so on. But I think there are different, it depends how you write the
description.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So as to what is controlled, what can change, and how that can be done. So there's tools, but it would be different, as you say, from any of the others that have been
put in place. By necessity, I think it would be different. Because, you know, some of the interventions have been pretty substantial.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just the fact this got dropped sort of 15 feet in height, and a bunch of additions have been put on the back, and it's quite different from what it was in 1977. So it's evolutionary. I don't know. Maybe it doesn't work as a historic precinct. I don't know.
But to explore for sure.
Yeah. Good.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you
well.
Very much.
Yeah, that was interesting. Wish you well with your project.
Yeah.
What is the relationship between this work and the fund?